I want to welcome you all, crowded in here, to the second lecture in the series, Centuries of Dialogues, Asia and the West, organized by our visiting professor for this year, Doug Berger, who is right here organizing this also as a class. And we're very, very grateful for the extremely hard work he's done at bringing international scholars from all of the world to speak in this lecture series. This lecture series is an attempt to show that the trajectory, or telos, if you like, of the stories of Western tradition have always been fruitfully and sometimes antagonistically in dialogue with other places, other questions, and other cultures. Last lecture, the first lecture of the series, was by Dr. Simon Ku of King's College, showing that the Enlightenment was far more than the cartoon version that we get from both critical theory and those that have supported it rather lately, and that it was in constant dialogue with those that supposedly don't have a history. Tonight's lecture is co-sponsored by two projects, including King's College, the Situating Science National Cluster of Historians, Philosophers of Science, which is winding up this year, is a long-term project to examine the situated state of science and technology. And its unruly child just started this year, a project that we're doing in collaboration with India, including Dr. Reina's institution on cosmopolitanism and the local in science and nature. Both of those things are available if you Google them, and you can see all of the kinds of things that we're doing. It's our great pleasure, as part of this project and part of the lecture series, to have Dr. Dhruv Reina all the way from JNU in Delhi. Now, this is a real trip to come all the way around the world to give this talk, and he just about didn't make it here for two reasons, one German and one Indian. The German one, Lufthansa went on strike as he was going to the airport, and our indefatigable Emily Techter, who runs the cluster, managed to shuffle him on another plane, and his car crashed that day. That's an Indian problem. If you've ever driven there. Every car has a dent. Dr. Reina is one of India's chief historians and philosophers of science, but is also renowned for his multiple studies of everything from Indian mathematics to problems of globalization, to the intertwining of indigenous knowledge, about the idea of post-colonial science. And he's written pretty much definitive pieces on each one of those. His projects have examined exactly what we are doing in this series, and he fits in perfectly. Dr. Reina is also known in Europe for all of his work on the globalized history and philosophy of science. And he was the great honor to have the first Heinrich Zimmer Chair for Indian Philosophy and Intellectual History at Heidelberg University as part of a big European project on examining different contacts between cultures. I could give you a bit of his history, but you people don't write this down, do you? Anyway?
No.
Studied physics at the great India Institute of Technology in Mumbai, and did his philosophy of science at Gutenberg in Germany, and his publication is just many. I'm not going to listen. Something about Dhruv, though, his exceptionally an unstoppable good cheer, especially at being hauled all the way around the world to meet with you. Students. Tomorrow he's going to meet with students at and other interested parties at 10 o'clock in the senior common room, so you're all welcome to come and berate him about what he said tonight. To meet with administrators, students, and fellow professors, and to especially to meet with you right now.
Thank you.
Dr.
Thank you, Gordon and Doug, for having me here, and King's College and the Situating Science Cluster for inviting me to deliver this talk. Several years ago, as part of a project on the history of global concepts, a colleague from Heidelberg University studying the history of Chinese logic, Joachim Kurz, and I jointly taught a course at the philosophy department of Heidelberg University called Philosophical Encounters Between East and West, where we had decided not to do comparative philosophy, but to study how concepts traveled and how they were employed as resources in different traditions. The course was taught in a department where Indian or Chinese philosophy had never been part of the curriculum. As we plowed through a surprisingly well-attended course, two things became evident. First, the discipline called Indian philosophy, as taught in university departments throughout the world, was shaped by the efforts of German and British Indologists and German philosophers. A thesis well developed in a paper by Peter Schreiner, published 7 or 8 years before Edward Said published his monumental Orientalism. Secondly, that in our own era, the histories of science and philosophy in South Asia are deeply entangled. In this talk, I briefly discuss a history of chemistry and in more detail, two histories of science written in English by Indians in the early 20th century as part of a larger study of the history of concepts that have acquired global currency. The concept of science is a singularly powerful, normative, and dominating one in the Anglophone world. Within the 19th century world of the institutionalization of disciplines under the organizational rubric of the university, the term came to connote not just a body of knowledge, but referred as much to a prescriptive protocol for making scientific discoveries or pursuing scientific research. By the middle of the 19th century, William Whewell had extended the term to allude to a community of individuals pursuing science in a focused manner. The term rapidly began to acquire the intimations of a cultural universal. The big picture of science did not fracture into a jigsaw, what Galison called, of islands of sciences till the last decades of the 20th century. The term by then had come to designate a plurality of epistemic and institutional cultures, often in up even distinct constellations of knowledge. Part of my effort here is to explore the naturalization of the terms positive sciences and exact sciences, qualifying science in late 19th century Bengal. The central question posed is how did Indians writing in the early decades of the 20th century construct the diverse knowledge systems of South Asia as positive or exact, and what did they mean by these terms? Histories of science in India began to be written in English, as I just said, by Indians towards the last decades of the 19th century and early decades of the 20th century. In this talk, as I said, I take up the discussion around the work of three authors, all published from Kolkata, in the first decades of the 20th century, these being the monumental History of Hindu Chemistry by P.C. Ray in 2 volumes, The Positive Sciences of the Ancient Hindus by Brijendranath Seel, and Hindu Achievements in the Exact Sciences and the Positive Background of Hindu Sociology by Binoy Kumar Sarkar. These books were published during the period of late colonialism, when a new national consciousness seeking to liberate itself of colonial rule had just about begun to orchestrate itself. All three figures were associated with the National Council of Education, an educational movement that sought to oppose the agenda of colonial education. As the first generation of Indian cultural amphibians entered the modern educational system, they were prompted to produce what the political philosopher Sudipto Kaviraj has called a reverse commentary. It could be argued that the notion of science framing these early works on the history of sciences in South Asia was at the time the dominant one in the philosophy of science discourse in the Anglophone world, presented in two master narratives by John Stuart Mill and William Whewell, respectively. To begin with, a few remarks on the first of these books. I shan't say too much about that one. The one on the history of chemistry by Acharya Prafulla Chandra Ray. I shall limit my remarks because I am rereading his work, having written about him 16 years ago, in an attempt to co-author a biography about him with a historian of political thought. Ray was a pioneer as a chemist and the founder of the Indian School of Modern Chemistry. He also published the first volume of a landmark work called The History of Hindu Chemistry. The first volume was published in 1902, inspired by a request from the Pope of French chemistry, Marcellin Berthelot. The work went on to become a classic in the field. The book has been the subject of scholarship and discussion among historians as well as historians of science, and I myself returned to his book after 16 years. In the discussion, I could tell you why I returned, but we can skip it for now. The question we could ask is, how are the compulsions of the reader related to the process of canonization or the making of a classic, if the history of Hindu chemistry is a classic? The Italian writer, novelist Italo Calvino, in his book on the uses of literature, pointed out to some of the features of a work considered a classic. I quote, "The classics are the books of which we usually hear people say, I am rereading, and never, I am reading," unquote. For in order to become a classic, a work must simultaneously be both relevant and outdated. And the context of relevance constantly changes with time, as the philosopher of science Gaston Bachelard has so eloquently argued. How else is one to understand, at the end of the 20th century, the Nobel laureate and theoretical astrophysicist S. Chandrasekhar's preoccupation with Newton's Principia? In other words, returning to Calvino, I quote again, "The classics are books that exert a particular influence, both when they refuse to be eradicated from the mind, where they conceal themselves in the folds of memory, camouflaging themselves in the collective or individual consciousness," unquote. Histories of Ayurveda and Indian alchemy, anchored in recently discovered sources and newer frames of interpretation, confer on The History of Chemistry by P.C. Ray a certain outdatedness, if not irrelevance. Thus, in an authoritative work on the Siddha traditions of medicine, published at the end of the last century, almost two decades ago, David Gordon White pointed towards a scholarly error promulgated by Prafulla Chandra Ray and subsequently amplified in the works of renowned Indologists and reiterated throughout the century by scholars. The error arose from a faulty manuscript that Ray consulted and attributed its authorship to Nagarjuna, which went on to determine Ray's conclusion that the early tantric treatises were of Buddhist origin. Remedying the scholarly error has not in any way eroded the merit of Ray's history, based as it was on a close reading of relevant Sanskrit and Pali manuscripts and texts. The continued relevance of Ray's work arises from the issues concerning scholars about the nature of Indian alchemy and its relation to chemistry, the issues concerning the circulation of tantric knowledge, not just about alchemy, but medical practices, and in an area so little discussed, it offers us one of the early discussions of the Needham question in the South Asian context. So in a way, what I'm saying is he poses the Needham question, at least in the South Asian context, at least 30 to 40 years before Needham posed the question for China. The latter, of course, is nested with current debates on counterfactual history, over underdeterminationist and overdeterminationist theories of history, and debates on modernity and social theory. So Ray continues to be relevant. The powerful presence of his history of chemistry over a century amidst the relevant classics of the histories of science in South Asia could be comprehended in terms of this hypertextual density, linked up with the fact that it does provide contemporary practicing Indian chemists an anchor for their own historical and cultural bearings. These earlier readings were understandably strongly entrenched in issues of what the sociologist Shri Vishwanathan has called cognitive justice. The attempts to engage with questions of the decline of the sciences in India or of the phenomenon of non-emergence of modern science. More than a decade after Ray had published his history as a practicing modern chemist, reviewing the progress of chemistry in Bengal, he reflected upon his historical magnum opus, where he had devoted a chapter to discussing the decline of the scientific spirit in India. He writes, I quote, "I lamented that the spirit of inquiry had died out amongst a nation naturally prone to speculation and metaphysical subtleties. Little did I dream then that in the course of a decade or so, I should have to revise the estimate I then formed of the capacities of my own countrymen and chronicle that a bright chapter is about to dawn in our life history." For him, then, the historical project and the spread of modern chemistry in India contributed to dispelling his image of the nation as predisposed to speculation and metaphysical reflection. The historical project provided a diagnosis of the past and offered cautionary lessons for the contemporary practice and development of modern chemistry. The appeal to the past was not so much about revival as to legitimate the contemporary pursuit of science. Speaking of the progress of chemistry in early 20th century Bengal, he would again remind his readers, I quote, "In my own history of Hindu chemistry, I have devoted a chapter to the discussion of some of the causes which brought about the decline of the scientific spirit in India, and how during the period of intellectual stagnation which set in our unhappy land was rendered morally unfit for the birth of a Boyle, a Descartes, or a Newton. We hope we have slept off the torpor of ages, and that it will be ours once more to extend the bounds of knowledge." Unquote. The books of Binoy Kumar, Brijendranath Seel on the positive sciences of the ancient Hindus and Binoy Kumar Sarkar are then among the first attempts of a class with a modern education to reconstruct the history of the sciences while responding to and contesting Western representations of Indian knowledge systems, working within the then current representations of the sciences. Let us begin with the work of Binoy Kumar Sarkar, since it provides us with an understanding of the received meaning of positive science. As the work of Geraldine Forbes and Yashoda Bagchi point out, the arrival of positivism in Bengal dates back to the 1860s. Having reached India through the efforts of the British positivists such as Congreve. In addition to positive ideas, certain Spencerian notions also acquired currency, for it was felt that this Western-educated Indian class, small though it be, would and could play a central role in initiating social progress. Sarkar was considered an influential cosmopolitan scholar in his time, but has since remained, as Partha Chatterjee writes, a footnote in the history of Indian sociology, who is still taught, if at all, only in Bengal. In 1918, he published The Hindu Achievements in the Exact Sciences, one amongst the very few slim volumes that he published, based on the secondary literature produced by British Indologists, a burgeoning community of Indian historians, and the European historians of science. The work attempted to offer a comprehensive account of science in ancient and medieval India by establishing the chronological links and logical affinities between the scientific investigations of the Hindus, the Greeks, the Chinese, and the Saracens. In other words, the history of science was about the history of transmissions embedded within a theory of what I would call epistemological correspondences. This work, produced during the rising tide of the nationalist struggle, sought to redress the paucity of literature on the history of Hindu and Chinese science. For in doing so, the students of comparative culture history could find that the tendencies of the Oriental mind have not been essentially distinct from those of the Occidental mind. The chapters on the different sciences are preceded here by one entitled Historical Perspective. That is of concern. For Sarkar, the exact sciences could be deductive mathematical or inductive physical. In either case, science was part of the commonwealth of nations that had contributed to their growth and development. Yet, recognizing that the contents of his book relate to an epoch of science considered pre-scientific, the merit of the argument could only be estimated against the backdrop of parallel developments amongst the Greeks, the Chinese, the Greco-Romans, and the Saracens. This rupture or break separating the pre-scientific from the scientific had been proposed by Whewell in his History of Inductive Sciences, where he had argued that the whole of pre-modern science displayed extreme ingenuity and subtlety, invention and connection, demonstration and method, and yet out of these no physical science may be developed. We may obtain by such means logic and metaphysics, even geometry and algebra, but out of such materials we shall never form optics and mechanics, chemistry and physiology. The methods of the pre-moderns could not have produced the exact sciences such as optics or mechanics, or the positive sciences such as chemistry and physiology. In broad agreement with Whewell's thesis that the pre-modern break was accounted for in terms of the invention of a new method, Sarkar would flag several points of disagreement. Firstly, the discipline of pure mathematics in India was fairly advanced in antiquity and the Middle Ages and had anticipated some of the European discoveries of the 16th to the 18th centuries. And this mathematics could well have been the basis for the mathematical sciences. The warrant for this inference probably came from the writings and translations of astronomical and mathematical manuscripts by Samuel Davis, Reuben Barrow, and H.T. Colebrook, and the subsequent integration of that work into the histories of mathematics, such as those authored by Florian Cajori. But these contributions were not merely restricted to the exact sciences, but to the positive sciences, though they possibly did not influence the development of modern science in the same manner as did the exact sciences. However, he goes on to readily admit that while writing was received like in other civilizations from the Phoenicians, and that the Indian astronomer Varahamihira reveals Greek and Roman sources, within quotes, India's indebtedness to foreign peoples for the main body of her culture has been virtually nil. You can see it was written in an age of growing nationalism. This radical alterity is needed in order to stage the central inference that the Hindu intellect has thus independently appreciated the dignity of objective facts, devised methods of observation and experiment, elaborated the machinery of logical analysis and truth investigation, attacked the external universe as a system of secrets to be unraveled and wrung out of nature, the knowledge which constitutes the foundations of science. This made the Indians too pioneers of science and exact positive material culture, which meant that no superiority could be claimed either for Greece or India, nor could any fundamental differences in mental outlook or vision be demonstrated between the two civilizations. This also reveals for us the importance science had acquired as a marker of difference and of the impact of Whewell's History of Inductive Sciences in prescribing an image of science that more or less defined the philosophical conception of science in not just Europe, but the South Asian context as well. Sarkar, as discussed in some earlier work, was part of an important cultural movement inaugurated by Satish Chandra Mukherjee called the National Council of Education, founded in the last decades of the 19th century, that split up in the first decade of the 20th century. Sarkar departed from the poet Rabindranath Tagore, Aurobindo Ghosh, and others, and argued for the materialistic and positive orientation of Indian culture. which would in turn strengthen India's claim for self-rule, whilst the idea of the otherworldliness of Indian culture was a self-fulfilling justification for colonial rule. In this attempt to revision even the social sciences, Sarkar identified several points of departure from standard conceptions of sociology and science. The study was based on an analysis of a Sanskrit work by Shukracharya called the Shukraniti. I shall omit a detailed discussion here, but raise a few salient issues from the work concerning the notions of the positive. But the important point is that the study of Indian civilization commenced with a re-examination of the methods hitherto adopted, their shortcomings and their relevance. Sarkar disengages his work from theories postulating progressive stages of social development. His concern was not to identify several stages in the making of modern Indian life and thought. Several broad points of departure may be identified, and these are balanced by several methodological and conceptual clarifications, one of which deals again with the notion of the positive. I briefly summarize some of his refutations and not the grounds for them. The first of the rejections addresses the portrayal of Indian civilization as transcendental or religious. Sarkar argues that the transcendental and other worldly aspects of Hindu life and thought have been made too much of. It has been supposed and believed during the last century that Hindu civilization is essentially non-economic and that its sole feature is ultra-asceticism. An over-religiosity such as delight in condemning the world, the flesh and the devil. Nothing can be farther from the truth. Evidently, the perceived inadequacy with this characterization of Indian culture is echoed in his unhappiness with Max Weber's sociology that runs as a chorus through the introductory chapter. A passage he finds particularly objectionable because it does not reflect for him the social reality of Indian life runs as follows. The Hindu spirit is very religious and very speculative. Obstinate guardian of traditions, it is singularly insensible to the joys of action and to demands of material progress. This, he indicates, is the most representative and substantial interpretation of the modern Euro-American world on Indian culture as developed in and through Hinduism and Buddhism. The second departure announces his rejection of the representation of India by Indologists, and he criticizes Max Müller for having merely presented the idealistic, the metaphysical or mystical side of Indian culture to the exclusion of its materialistic, secular and objective side. It was this side that Sarkar was interested in revealing. Methodologically, this representation, he says, was a product of three fallacies. The most obvious of which was the ignorance of the positive, materialistic, secular institutions and theories of the Hindus. The second arose from a comparative reading of history marked by a deep chronological asymmetry. Features of ancient and medieval India were frequently compared with contemporary features of the Euro-American world. Within the historiography of progress, this portrayed the West as enlightened and progressive, while India was arrested in tradition and scholastic medievalism. And finally, the most important objection that was even more difficult to dismiss was the inability to differentiate or appreciate the distinction between institutions and ideals. Reversing these methodological fallacies would become Sarkar's cause célèbre. What did Sarkar mean by the term positive? To evince this, we have to go back to Auguste Comte's ideas of the functional evolution of mankind, characterized by three mental stages, and the last of the stages, the état positif, is marked by the reign of reason and experience. Sarkar proceeds to depart from this picture, for the only liaison he sees between the positive background of Hindu sociology and Comte's philosophie positive lies in the value he attaches to the category positive. This he proceeds to construe as an assemblage or an association of scholarly activity, exact knowledge, experience or experiment, generalization, specialization, science as antithesis of religion. In other words, the idea of the positive ensconces the notion of an intellectual reform that precedes the social reform of society. Thus, while concurring with the notion of the positive, he objects to the law of three stages. These objections arise from his understanding of Indian society and are at the same time inspired by Western critics of Auguste Comte, such as Brunswick and Levi Brull. Sarkar rejects Comte's law of three stages as an objective exhibition of the dynamics of culture history. The theory is rejected on the grounds that historically it would be impossible to identify an epoch where reason ruled supreme to the exclusion of imagination or experience, or even so where the writ of imagination prevailed to the exclusion of experience or reason, or even further, experience prevailed to the exclusion of imagination and reason. In other words, the idea of sequential development and progress was not found acceptable. It was argued that there were no anthropological or psychological grounds to infer that imagination belonged to the primitive mind alone, and this stage was a precursor to that where ratiocination and concrete experience dominated. Sarkar was in the process of rejecting the characterization of Indian civilization as anchored in a stage where the spiritual and metaphysical were predominant. How exactly did Sarkar envisage changing this picture of India and bringing out its positive side? This was programmatically to be accomplished by altering the focus of priorities of research towards the history of Indian art and its crafts, a study of its economy and political systems over the centuries. Further, the literatures of Hindustan, Sanskritic, Dravidian, and the vernaculars were to be approached by the respective canons of literary criticism of these traditions. This, he says, would tell us more about the marriage rules, the joint family, the cottage industry, the autonomous system of cooperative village communities, the elastic theological apparatus in religious paraphernalia, the institution of kinship that constitute the complex of Indian life. This brings me to the last of the points about Sarkar I wish to emphasize, namely his symmetrical approach to the study of modernity both in the East and West. Thus, it is argued that the new technological discoveries such as the steam engine, the steam and machine age were surely revolutionary for Asians as they were for the Euro-American world. Consequently, these developments were not to be taken as signs of particularly Occidental or non-Oriental exceptionalism. On the other hand, since the site of some of these discoveries was Europe and these revolutionary changes emanated from there, it could not either be argued that they were unsuited to the Oriental genius or antagonistic to the spirit of the Orient, and finally, that they were emblematic of materialist civilization. On the contrary, while these developments were modern, this revolutionary age is to be seen as constituting one of the faces of the world's evolution. These developments could be assimilated by any system of human polity depending on the stage and requirements of its growth. And yet, in denying a European exceptionalism, he was also denying Indian exceptionalism. He was not predisposed to asserting Indian or Hindu exceptionalism. The symmetry underlying this approach reinforced his attempts at constructing a more robust social theory. Thus, he was to write, "So-called Hindu ideals, there are none. There is nothing exclusively Indian in Hindu culture. Any idea, fact or truth alleged to be the essential characteristic of the spirit of Hinduism is at the same time the feature of the genius of other lands. And here, most importantly, India is not one but many." We see, therefore, in Sarkar's oeuvre a meeting ground of Western critiques of positivist social theory and Indian resistance to constructions in the terms of this very social theory. In other words, he did not envisage a complete break with Western social theory or history, and he feels that a proper appreciation of the achievements of the sciences of India could only be acquired against the backdrop of the landmarks in the history of Western science. The application of this method would, for him, reveal that the idea that the Indian mind was predisposed naturally to metaphysical and unpractical speculation was founded in what he terms malobservation or non-observation. I come now to the last of the books I'm speaking of, and that is Brijendranath Seel's Positive Sciences of the Hindus. Seel recuperates a positivist notion of science from Indian alchemy and medicine. He was a philosopher who probably wrote the first epistemological thesis on the sciences of India in English. This dissertation was subsequently worked into a book. I would like, in a way, to read both these works together for a number of reasons. Firstly, because both scholars belong to the same social network of the Bengali intelligentsia. Their writing was aimed at creating new educational material, methodologies, and textbooks. Thus, for the new pedagogies, an attempt to restore, refurbish, and revitalize the past was required. Seel's book had a more lasting reception than possibly did Sarkar's. This is because it became one of another of the canonical texts of the history of science and scientific method of the period. The last chapter of the book was republished in the History of Hindu Chemistry by P.C. Ray. As a result, it was canonized as an authoritative statement on the methodology of the sciences of India. The work was published before Sarkar's book and is anchored in the very intellectual and cultural projects that had inspired or provoked Sarkar's work. It is very likely, and that's something I'm working on, that chapter 7 of the book was appended later to his completed dissertation. He starts out by suggesting that the necessity for studying the methodology of the sciences of India derives from the need to arrive at a right understanding of the Hindu positive sciences. Seel attempts to take on board, as a philosopher would do, its strength and its weaknesses, its range and limitations. In this project, then, he has to confront the so-called, what I call the binary dichotomies of the history of science of the 19th century. The purpose of his enterprise is thus to show that this science was not all practical recipe and unverified speculation, and that the movement was positively scientific. Seel, like most members of his generation, bites into the trope of the decline of the sciences of India, whose growth, he suggests, was arrested at an early stage. For this generation, I mean, a contemporary historiography of science departs from this, a great deal from this idea. For this generation of Indians, the received theory of science was that of an inductivist science. Seel appeared to have been producing a response to John Stuart Mill's systems of logic. In this last chapter of about 50 pages, laying out the methodology of sciences of India, Mill's system of logic is referred to about 8 to 10 times. Mill's system of logic was published in 1843, and in addition to logic, Mill discussed the methods of science in studying natural and social phenomena. Thus, while the book was titled Systems of Logic, one should not be deluded into thinking that it was a work on formal logic. On the contrary, Mill's proposal of the logic of consistency dealt with the procedure of deriving conclusions from evidence based on an analysis of causation and inductive reasoning. The principles of experimental sciences were discussed in Book 3 of the Systems of Logic. And this is not the place to discuss Mill's systems of logic, but to suggest that Mill's work serves Brijendranath Seel as a template or exemplar for the exposition of the methodology of the sciences of India. Other than the obvious cultural combat that underpins Seel's work, this could as well be read as a work in comparative epistemology. Interestingly, Seel's book, while written in English, is generously punctuated with quotations from Sanskrit texts in Sanskrit, and has four indices at the end of a book, a large number given that the book was only of about 290 pages, exclusive of the index. The first index is in Sanskrit and lists the Sanskrit authorities cited. The second is also in Sanskrit and indexes the Sanskrit text cited. The third is again in Sanskrit, indexing the philosophical terms employed in Sanskrit, and this is followed by an index in English, not as detailed as the previous two. I leave out the paratextual analysis here. I mean, it'll appear in a paper shortly, I hope. Further, if we were to scrutinize the section headings of Chapter 7 of John Stuart Mill's Systems of Logic and Chapter 7 of Brijendranath Seel's book, a pattern becomes evident. The pattern reveals that the organization of Mill's chapter provides Seel with a structural template to discursively expose the methodology of the sciences in India. The approach consisted in revealing the inductive method by proceeding sequentially from a discussion of observation to experiment to reasoning, a discussion on causality, and finally the grounds, for instance. Strangely enough, though Immanuel Kant was a favorite among Western philosophers, with both Brijendranath Seel and Binoy Kumar Sarkar, they did not stray too far from inductivism as a philosophy of science. Thus, Seel proceeds to suggest that the Indian physico-chemical theories and classifications commenced with the observation of instances that were analyzed and sifted. This procedure was meticulously followed in the Materia Medica and Meteorology. Lest it be construed that this was the character of the whole movement, Seel is quick to point out that as far as observational astronomy was concerned, the quality of the observations were, to say the least, lacking. However, he had to explain the agreement between the calculation of the lunar constants entering into the calculations of lunar periods and eclipses with the figures in Laplace's table. Laplace publishes a paper in 1770s in the Bureau de Longitude where he takes up some of the calculations, computations of the so-called, within quotes, the traditional Indian astronomers. This was accomplished by a systematic process of verification and a correction by comparison of the computed with the observed results over more than 1,000 years. Does the overall structure fit into an inductive framework? Seel was very cautious about making this claim, for he points out that the experiment as an independent method of proof of or discovery was rarely recorded in books. Was rarely recorded in books, though they were not entirely absent. Having said that, he points out the rare instances where experiments were referred to in works such as Udayana's Kirnavali. The vocation of the terms exact and positive, two terms employed to characterize the so-called sciences of Indian antiquity, is to be contextualized within the larger history of the institutionalization of the natural and social sciences in late colonial India. And yet, both these terms are key concepts in the Methodist rite that animated the philosophy of sciences from the end of the 19th century in the West. This concurrence is not accidental. The philosopher J.N. Mohanty outlined several approaches to a comparative philosophy. One of the paths was referred to as the path of the wisdom seeker. And this path is, in the context of the discussion of our interlocutors, is characterized by an asymmetry. Indian philosophy is portrayed as mystical, and a blind eye is turned to the analytical, logical, or epistemological components or traditions in Indian philosophy. In this manner, a particular construction of Indian philosophy is reproduced on both sides of the East-West philosophical divide. Both Seel and Sarkar dissociate themselves from this approach. I suspect that these two works fall into this genre of comparative exploration. In an earlier study with my colleague Irfan Habib, we had used the term critical assimilation to refer to one response of cultural redefinition of modern scientific knowledge in late 19th century India. Though the response was so characterized, you know, more than two decades ago, I think this term still does some justice to the project of these two philosophers. Seel and Sarkar would have been trenchantly critical and probably abusive of Mill the Father's History of India, that 19th century master narrative providing a justification for colonial rule and the civilizing mission. And yet, the same Brijendranath Seel would be inspired by Mill the Son's Systems of Logic and employ it as a model for revealing the methodology of the sciences of India. We may marvel at Seale's scholarship and reading. We may find his identification of correspondences and cognitive homologies for translating Indian philosophy into a Western system highly problematic from the perspective of contemporary debates in Indian philosophy. Similarly, Sarkar, as a perceptive critique of Comte's stereo theory of social evolution, would still consider the sociological project worthwhile enough to indicate what should be studied and how. So while the term critical assimilation would functionally describe the process I have just mentioned, we have here a glimpse of how an image of a neutral and objective science had managed to seduce and lodge itself in the late 19th century Indian imagination. Post-colonial theorists could well pose the counterfactual. Why didn't they invent other narratologies and theories of translation? Alas, this is destined to remain a question for our age and our time, and not for these two interlocutors. Thank you very much.
So we have about a half an hour of questions, and then we're going to go to a reception outside. not outside, it's too cold, but outside this room here. So we'll start questions for a half an hour. Some questions?
No.
Don't make me go over there and get you. Okay. Yep.
This historian Gavril wrote a symmetry to his comments on the similarities between Vajrayana and alchemy, and when Western alchemy, if that was something that was commented on, because of this historical asymmetry comparing the evil Indian chemistry and science to contemporary European science, for instance.
Yeah. In a forthcoming paper, I have worked on where does P.C. Rai's historiography of chemistry come from. And he is deeply influenced by the work of Hofer's Geschichte der Chemie, by Thomson's History of Chemistry, and by one more, Histoire de Chemie. These are the three important works of the first half of the 19th century. Now, one of the problems historians of chemistry in the 19th century, and my argument in the paper is that even in the 19th century, the identity of chemistry vis-a-vis other disciplines is unstable. They are embarrassed about the origins of chemistry in alchemy. And what happens is, if you look at the landmarks in the history of chemistry that are of alchemy, chemistry, the turning point is the work of Paracelsus. Right? It's the beginning of iatro chemistry and then gradually moving on to chemistry. And for P.C. Rai, when he looks at the work, now Rasayana is, in a way, you want to call it, we're in the realm of problematic translation, but the science of mercury, let me say for simplicity. Now, in Rai's history of chemistry, the third phase of the history of alchemy, where alchemy becomes no longer alchemy but an iatro chemistry, is the introduction of heavy metals for the treatment of disease. Alright, this is due to an influence of tantric alchemy and things like this. So he finds there now a parallel trajectory towards the emergence the development of alchemy in India with the development of alchemy in the West. Of course, there's a question of priority there, but he's not too concerned about it, but there's a priority that this happens at least 400 years in India than it happened with Paracelsus. But having said that, for him, the modern chemistry's identity begins in the work of Lavoisier, the end of the 18th century, and that is chemistry for him. All right, and in his own work and a lot of what he's doing, I mean, he himself was a student of Crum Brown at Edinburgh in the 1870s, and he himself worked at the intersection of pharmacology and organic chemistry. So that was an area. So I argue that there's a very strong connection between his historical reflections on science and the science he does. And that's during a phase that extends from 1890 to 1905. I call that the science of Mercury years. Right, so there's a strong connection between these two. So he takes the benchmarking, the milestones in the history of evolution of chemistry in the West, as a sort of benchmark that then enables him to plot the trajectory of the history of alchemy in India. The only difference is, I think, that he was asked to write this history by Berthelot, who was writing L'Histoire d'Alchimie and L'Histoire de l'Alchimie Grecque. And he said, I haven't seen anything in India. So he asked Ray to write it. But no, Berthelot is embarrassed about the past of chemistry. And that presentist view is never taken by P.C. Ray. He sees it as part of the development of the discipline. So he's not embarrassed by the alchemical past. And that Berthelot is, of course, I mean, Bernadette Vincent. I mean, all her work has, I mean, some of her work points out that how deeply embarrassed 19th century practicing chemists were with the past of their discipline, and given the way physics was evolving with the other disciplines were evolving.
In your talk, you mainly refer to Indian science, but all your authors are actually saying Hindu.
No, you know, I mean, it is an important question that, you know, all these books are referred to as the history of Hindu chemistry, the history of, if you look into the books, there's nothing Hindu in the book, right? But my own feeling is that they were inheriting these classifications in the history of science from earlier generations of historians of science, you know, I mean, if we assume that history of science in its modern avatar or incarnation begins towards the end of the last decades of the 18th century, where disciplinary histories begin to be written, then if you look at how these are designated, then les sciences andou, all right? I mean, those are the kinds of terms they work with. But other than that, it's empty. And however P.C. Ray claims in his own history of Hindu chemistry, I have not written the history of Arab alchemy in India or it's the Indian, because I am not familiar with Arabic, but it is something I should have written. All right? I mean, there is a feeling, there is a contemporary argument by post-colonial theorists that, you know, the beginnings of this kind of Hindu chauvinism go back to this period. Maybe they do, but it's not reflected in any of these works, not at all. And Berthelot himself accused P.C. Ray of nationalism, but the grand old man of chemistry, Svante Arrhenius, and the others who reviewed the book said the work was free of any kind of nationalism. So I think it was a shorthand they used to designate the Sanskritic systems of knowledge which they inherited from earlier historians of science and mathematics.
Wondering about the secularism, and it maybe follows a little bit from this question. So Sandra Harding has this evocative idea that, you know, Western secularism is very different from Indian secularism, it's very different from various other secularisms, and that there's a kind of Western tendency to assume that a North American European secularism is what secularism is for everyone. And so I was just wondering, if there's nothing Hindu in these books, then are they secular? And in what sense are they secular? Do you find types of Indian metaphysics reverberating through in the analysis? Or is it kind of, does it take over more of a Euro-secular scientific perspective? Just see what I mean?
I think in Sandra Harding's Is Science Multicultural, there is a point which is kind of arguable also, that in a way, the internal history of science is Eurocentric. All right, and you say the work of Saliba and others, played a role.
Take that
bit. So I was coming to these people, when they're writing, are already now exposed to the range of 19th century histories of science which have been written, all of these people. Now, which they take as a template, the argument I'm making it for them, science is a culture. None of them would have said that science is not a cultural universe. They are ingrained in positive science. And within that framework now, they are constructing their histories. This is going to be very different from the kind of histories of science which are written in the 1980s. But at the end of the 19th centuries, within that framework of science as cultural universal, they are producing their histories, one. But, I suppose the Sanskritists will also tell you that if you pick up the philosophical works, they are not necessarily religious works, okay? But, a political theorist at my university and Delhi and all would go along entirely with this point that Indian secularism is very different from Western secularism or in secularism in the American world. But I think their understanding of secularism here would be what they had inherited from what they had read, or what they had internalized from what they had read in the 19th century. All right, so if you look at the histories of science which they read, and that's something documented, then this is what they got their ideas from. And over there, you're arguing within that framework.
As opposed to the chiefly theoretical and practical texts, the logical method, which Seale said was scarce in written records, was that passed down through some oral pedagogical tradition within the pre-colonial Institute of Science in India?
No, they were logical texts. There is an organon, right, when it comes to logic. The Nyaya Sutras are there, and there is, everybody comes along and writes a Nyaya Sutra from the work of Gautam onwards, and he is he's familiar with that tradition. He exposes that tradition, and he also then goes on to argue as to how the logical traditions influence the development of medicine, particularly the debates on the etiology of disease in the Charaka Sanhita and others. So, no, I don't think that, at this time you could see the tradition purely as an oral one in the 19th century or the 18th century. There was an oral side to it, but there were also texts which were being passed on. Bengal is very famous for a school of logic called the Navadvipa School of Logic, the new school of logic, and it's very well known for that. And I suppose, that was knowledge passed within the school, it's kind of textual knowledge, but they would also have been oral learning. So I don't push for the argument that it was an exclusively oral tradition, because it was both, right? Especially when you come into the medieval ages. If you read the work of Sanjay Subramaniam and others, when they talk about Rajasthan, they talk of Rajasthan as one of the foremost paper cultures on the Indian subcontinent. Right, and this is during the Mughal period and after.
Just this might be a summative question, and relate to what the other questions are, but would it be right to say that, at least with Sarkar, that he is rejecting the claim that he's promoting a nationalist science, and at the same time, would it be right to say that he would say, and the others, that the West got science and India got science, although differently? Criticism that India itself is actually inherently different from the West is an incorrect view, because if you were to look at the classical writings of the West and the classical writings of India, that it would show that although, whether it's polytheistic or monotheistic, that there is the same guiding force towards science, and that the Western claim, or at least with Max Weber, they're saying, is a kind of an arrogant bird's eye view versus the humble and
I don't think, I mean, you would have seen Max, he does disagree with this characterization of Indian society as preoccupied with the spiritual and the metaphysical. And he would take the view, I mean, you know, if you look at the scope of his history, although it's a small book, he's looking at the movement of ideas across the globe. You know, he wants to do a comparative history of the simultaneous development of ideas in China, in India, in the Arab world, amongst the Saracens in the West. And I don't think he sees that that science is particularly a European invention. He doesn't see that, no.
And will he reject the positivist claim?
No, no. What he rejects about positivism is sociological positivism. All right? I mean, basically the law of three stages. You know, I mean, by the end of the 19th century, a certain kind of social Darwinism had become current even amongst colonial officials, where the ideology of progress finds a legitimacy in the theory of biological evolution. All right, but in evolution there is no progress. All right, so the criticism is of this kind of the larger criticism of this grand conflation of evolutionary theory with the idea of social progress. Yeah. So, I mean, I think Sarkar is quite clear in the passages I have cited that they don't accept this. You know, I mean, every stage is an improvement on the previous stage of development. Whether you're talking of Marxism or you're talking of Auguste Comte or the late Enlightenment thinkers. There's this notion that society goes through these stages of development and every subsequent stage is in a betterment over the previous stage, and he's not accepting that.
He's basically saying a more human approach instead of looking at it through a separated function, that there's more of a, you don't have to make distinctions of nationalities for science, but that there's an actual similarity.
I don't know whether he's saying similarity, but he's saying that, well, I mean, you know, also there is this kind of positive activity which characterizes all societies. So, you know, I mean, and so I mean, the societies have the religious side, but there's the side of production, there's the side of culture, there are institutions. And what British or what Orientalism has done is it's emphasized the spiritual at the cost of the other aspects of society. I was telling Gordon about 2 hours ago that there's a letter from somebody on whom Gordon has written a great deal, J.B.S. Haldane, the British biologist who settled down in India, to Joseph Needham. And I got a version of the letter from the historian of science, Simon Schaefer, and J.B.S. Haldane writes to, from India, he writes to Needham, and he says, you know, you think I probably turned Indian and I'm going around in Indian clothes and living in Chennai and all that. No, I mean, I haven't quite become like that. But I think that far too much emphasis is given to the religious side of Hinduism rather than to its more practical and industrious aspects. I mean, those are the actual words he uses. All right, and he's writing as late as the 1950s to Joseph Needham, whose own sensibilities about China had been quite detailed and sophisticated. Okay, so.
By the 1980s, though, the nationalist movement's understanding of science radically changes, right? Where two things happen, it seems. One is that the re-emphasis of the notion that there is a difference in the styles of reasoning and radical difference between Hindu understanding of the world and the Western one, which is involved alienation, objectivity and the scientizing of everything, combined, it seems, at exactly the same time with notions that we discovered at first. whatever that is, we are actually the roots of that. And it's kind of a weird contradiction.
You know, in the 1950s, when Needham started out on the Science and Civilization project, he turned a number of discoveries technological and scientific which had been attributed to the West, he turned them over to China. And he said, no, they were discovered there. And of course, he was playing a game. And the game he was playing was, now the burden of proof is on you. You have to prove, disprove me that I'm wrong. This is what I say. And these are the reasons why I'm saying it. And so in all decolonizing nations then, there is this preoccupation with these priority disputes. And that's understandable in the 50s and the 60s. You know, I mean, that's the first stage because Eurocentrism is still alive and kicking despite the effects of Needham and Lucien Febvre and, you know, I mean, Auger and Julian Huxley and others through UNESCO. But in a way, it still lives. But I think the change in the 1980s is, again, as Sandra Harding points out, there's a conjuncture at a global level of several forces. I mean, one is, you know, I mean, post-colonial philosophy of science, feminist philosophy of science, and then, I mean, what you might call post-colonial theory. At least its manifestation in India was that the first generations of investigators were largely physicists and scientists who were doing history of science. And suddenly what happens in the 1980s is anthropologists come in, sociologists come in, and so there's the Indian equivalent of the social turn to the social studies of science. And then they begin to see the social embodiedness and grounding of science in, you know, in a different way, which of course is then construed by the nationalists in the 1990s to say other things. Right? But that was not the intention in the 1980s. In the 1980s, there was an overall disenchantment with development, with the modernity, with the Nehruvian mandate that had not delivered on development. But there were also these other movements in the academy. Largely in the 1980s. I mean, you had a kind of social studies of science from the 1950s, largely in the Marxist tradition, inspired by the work of J.D. Bernal and Joseph Needham. So that's the period of the 1950s and the 1960s. And then late 1970s, 1980s, you see the social, Shiv Vishwanathan, Ashish Nandi, J.P.S. Oberoi, this whole tradition.
Ian.
I was going to ask you, is it correct to say that the rewriting of the history of science in India is essentially a rediscovery of the positive elements within the Hindu tradition? Is that a correct understanding of what you're talking about?
Yes.
The question then becomes, what is it that encouraged a retreat from those positive elements in the Hindu tradition in the previous several hundred years? I'm thinking particularly of the influence of the Muslim presence and Muslim culture.
You know, I mean, this is a deeply debated issue. I mean, I'm not going along with the historiography which says that it went into decline.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
So I don't go along with that view. It was on along another trajectory of development. And so it doesn't go into decline. And then if you look at it, I mean, if you look at the recent work of historians like Sheldon Pollock, Sanjay Subramaniam, Muzaffar Alam, Corin Prasindans, and this whole school, Christopher Minkowski, actually the medieval period was actually a period of great interaction between the Islamic tradition and the scientific tradition, of very, very deep interaction in the fields of medicine, in the fields of astronomy. I mean, we seem to have lived throughout the 1950s and the 1960s with this ideological, you know, I mean, fixation that, you know, the medieval period was a Muslim period. Yeah, the rulers were Muslim, but it was a great period Janardhan Ganeri has a book called The Lost Age of Reason, and Sheldon Pollock speaks of the birth of an Indian modernity concurrent with Western modernity, all right, where new styles of writing appear, new genres of writing appear. Sanskrit intellectuals begin to refer to themselves as Navya, new, as different from the past. I mean, so there's Navya Nyaya or new Nyaya, there's Navya Vyakarna. And if you look at the work of Dominic Ujastik on Indian, on medicine, I'll just give you an example of two texts and stop, basically to make my point. So There's an Ayurveda scholar called Nolimba Raja who writes a book on liver diseases. And he's a Brahmin married to a Muslim woman. Right? So these boundaries are travestied in more than one way. And he writes a book and he says, well, you know, the ancients really understood the body, and he pays his tribute to the tradition. And then 10 verses down, he says, you know, but they never understood liver disease. And now I will tell you about liver disease. And that's one book. And the other work is a work of Yogeshwara, 17th century, who mounts an attack on the Ashtanga Hriday and the epidemiology of disease. And Vireshwara starts out by saying that the greatest of Ayurveda scholars alive today is Biharilal Mishra, and of his students, I am the greatest. So, you know, he's got this kind of style of writing in them. He also begins to pay his obeisance to the tradition, and then a few shlokas down the line, he says, he actually uses the term that, you know, on epidemiology, all the wisdom of the ancients is but babbling of fools. You know, so, I mean, so there's an image that the tradition has stagnated. It was not. There were new things coming out, and actually his critique of Ayurvedic epidemiology is very, very substantial. Although what he offers in turn is not so well developed, that's another issue. So the tradition is really quite alive. So I don't accept the view that the Middle Ages were a dark. No.
It is. Actually, we want maybe a couple more. Is there anybody online that's asking questions? Ask a question.
Yeah. Okay. In 5th century BC, when Nagarjuna was in Nalanda, the India was booming in terms of philosophy, logics, and metaphysics. So, and Nagarjuna formed this Mahayana Buddhism, and during like in 5th century, he wrote this the fundamental verses of the middle way. But I was reading this book, written by Pankaj Mishra, in it's called An End to the Suffering, the Buddha in the World, where he mentioned that, you know, Nietzsche had a misconception view on emptiness or middle way approach. So he Nietzsche thought that the emptiness is equal to nihilism. But the conception itself is very different, right? Because so have you encountered anyone like any scholar discussing about this way, you know, like the misconception?
You know, I mean, there are always misconceptions in translations. I don't know how to answer your question. Well, if you go back to the end of the 18th century, when the French began to institutionalize in some way the history of science. So Jean-Sylvain Bailly produces a Traité sur l'astronomie indienne, and he also writes a history of astronomy in French. Histoire d'Astronomie, and Lalande also produces another one. And in these works, they have a problem. The problem they have is they are writing a history of a discipline which is seen as the history of human intelligence. And for them, following Fontenelle and Voltaire, the history of human intelligence is the only history which displays or exhibits the notion of progress. Right, so they are writing the history of astronomy in a particular way, and suddenly they see some Jesuit records. They see the records of Le Gentil in Pondicherry, and they encounter algorithms there which predate Kepler by 300 years. Right, and here they encounter what I call a disruption in the narrative of progress. Okay, so in the sciences, you have to now say, how do I fit this disruption in this narrative of progress? Because I am telling you a story where development 1 leads to 2, leads to 3, leads to 4, and this is the way it happens in the European tradition. And then something is happening there, but that's not part of this narrative, right? So that's one kind of argument you encounter. Another view would be taken by somebody like Ananda Kumaraswamy, the Sri Lankan historian of art. He, in a book called Time and Eternity, he says that most ideas figure in all cultures in different ways. So more or less, he says, there's no point writing a history of priority. It makes no sense because all ideas will erupt in different forms, in different cultures and societies. So that's another view. But I mean, misunderstandings of concepts are many. I mean, are we sure we have understood Nagarjuna today?
If there's any other question, anybody come on? We're broadcasting this around the world, so.
No, you're not.
your wife back in there eating chips or something. Yeah.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, well, I want to thank Dr.